Welcome to Back to My Garden. Discover your passion for gardening. Here's Dave Ledoux.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world when you listen to this. I'm Dave Ledoux, and welcome to another episode of Back to My Garden. And I have a feeling this is going to be a spectacular episode going all the way across North America to the West Coast. Amy loves to connect with nature. She works with clients to design beautiful, tranquil, and inspired gardens. Amy enjoys teaching, especially intimate space design and native plant habitats. She has a gift for helping people to adopt new eyes to see a garden as it could be rather than how it is. Amy Gardens in Portland, Oregon. Please welcome to the show Amy Whitworth. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Dave. Happy to be here.
Yeah, exciting. I'm glad you're here. I gave you a brief introduction. I want to get to know you better, and our listeners definitely want to hear your stories. Amy, take a minute or two. Explain to everybody, how did you get into gardening?
I have always loved plants. I had my mom used to grow African violets, and she would propagate them in the basement under grow lights. And we had a little garden in the backyard. And so I always had a connection with plants. And after I graduated high school and looking towards what to do for my career, I looked towards plants. And so I went to school for horticulture and ended up taking a turn and ended up getting my degree in fine arts, in fiber art, actually, craft. So after that, I went back to my first love, which was horticulture and plants. And so although I thought at the time it was kind of a strange route for me, it turned out to be the perfect route because it tied together my two loves of art and horticulture.
Nice. For those of you driving in your car, Amy and I are going to kick back and relax and talk about gardening for the next half hour. I'll have all of the links and resources that we share up on the blog at backtomygarden.com. Make sure you follow Amy's website. Check it out. She has a resource site at www.planetearthdesign. It's actually plan-it-earthdesign. I'll link that on the blog. Amy, you pressed one of my buttons. I grew up and my mom is British and she grew African violets, giant hanging baskets in the living room that as kids we weren't allowed to touch.
Don't touch the leaves.
And they kind of droop down out of the basket, you know, 2-3 feet long.
Nice.
And it was very rare that it would flower because, in Canada you don't have the climate for or the sunlight, but I remember those days.
Yeah, I still love African violets.
It's not very, I have to pick my words carefully, trendy or in vogue like it was in the 70s?
No, not at all. But they do make a beautiful flower, and they're pretty easy to grow.
Nice.
So, having flowers indoors is always really a plus. And that's the other piece of my background, which is that I really started my professional plant career working with interior plants and interior plantscaping. And I lived in New York at the time and kind of had this thought, I want a green plant in every window in New York. That was kind of what I dreamed of.
Nice.
And it was great and really fun. And but I started to get pretty frustrated because really tropical plants, they don't want to grow in an indoor environment. I mean, they can grow and they can flower, but it always seemed, especially in an office environment, which is what I did a lot of, it was just a matter of time until they started to deteriorate and go downhill. And it was just a matter of trying to keep them alive. So my movement from indoors to outdoor gardening, from indoor plantscaping to landscaping, was kind of a remarkable opening door to me. And that all happened when I moved to Portland, when I moved from indoors to outdoors and growing plants that actually wanted to thrive instead of die.
It must have been a bit of a culture shock moving from New York City to Portland in terms of climate, space. I mean, in New York City, you're gardened by the square inch, it would seem.
Yeah, there wasn't much room outside the garden, and thus the indoor thrust. But I was looking for a quieter place. I still liked the city, but it was a little too crazy for me in New York, and Portland was kind of a perfect landing pad. And at the time, I didn't even realize what an amazing garden mecca it was. I mean, I probably should have done my research better, but I kind of landed in Shangri-La of gardening world.
All right, so here we go, a little controversy. Because we have listeners now in 65 countries, which I can't even fathom.
Amazing.
I'm sure there are people right now listening in England that would say, you don't know gardening mecca, you got to come to England. But tell me a couple of the hot things that make Portland a gardening mecca.
Well, the climate, for one thing. I mean, we live in a very, very temperate climate. We get all four seasons, which I love and is really important to me. So we do have seasonal changes, but it doesn't get super cold in the winter. We're zone 7, and we often stretch into zone 8, particularly in the city. So we can grow a lot of things. We get a lot of rain. Plants grow really well and really fast here. And a lot of people think of the Pacific Northwest as a super wet area, which it is, except that during our growing season, the spigots get turned off and it's just dry. So we have 3 seasons of rain and then 1 season of drought, and that's kind of gardening in the Pacific Northwest. The winter is lush and mossy and green and abundant, and it's pretty unusual for, I guess, coming from the East Coast at least, thinking about lush greenery in the wintertime. That was pretty unique for me.
We'll send our thoughts down to our friends like in places like Texas and Arizona, where they're just in this unbelievable drought. And when they hear words like mossy and lush and green, it's a different world down there.
Absolutely.
In your bio, you made something that said something that intrigued me is, we have a lot of listeners that live in big cities, in, you know, those big condo towers, and they garden on tiny balconies and patios.
Yeah.
I've always thought that, you know, hey, anybody can have an acre or 2-acre garden, but it's far more challenging with those small, intimate spaces. And I know that's your specialty. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's definitely, you know, definitely possible to grow pretty much anything you want. I mean, it takes a determination, and it takes a lot more planning, because you just can't, you know, when you have acreage, you can just plant whatever you want, wherever you want, however you want, pretty much. When you have a really small space, you get maybe 3 pots, and you have to choose what is it that you're trying to grow. Do you want something edible? Do you want flowers? Do you want texture? You know, what is it that you're trying to do? So that's the challenge of small space gardens, is really the puzzle pieces of how it all looks, what the intention is, and, you know, the conditions that are going to support the plant growth.
You know, I'm trying to think, when I lived in the city, it was always speed and stress and drama. Do you have like a secret bag of tricks if somebody's trying to build a space to de-stress their life? What are some of the things you would do in a space like that that's important to consider?
Well, I mean, I think anything green in a space is going to help to reduce stress. So, you know, that's why looking for a green plant in every window in New York City, I just really feel that that's having some sort of living greenery near you is really crucial. So it kind of depends on what makes you happy as far as my bag of tricks. I mean, one of the things that I love, that I think about when you mention that is there's a little event that happens every summer in Portland. Different weekends, there's a bike ride that happens throughout the neighborhood, and they call it Sunday Parkways. And people in the neighborhood just kind of cruise around for a, I don't know, maybe 3-mile circuit with their bikes. And my house tends to be on the circuit for one of these parkways. And so I make a little garden space in my driveway and let people know what it is that I do and try to promote gardens. And this is, you know, just a concrete little sunken concrete walls and a concrete floor and kind of a little bit of a funky garage that I'm setting up in front of. And I just lay down a beautiful outdoor mat, bring a couple of chairs, an umbrella, lots of colorful pots. And all of a sudden, the space looks like a garden. And, you know, it's just a crappy piece of concrete with walls. You know, it just turns it around into a desirable space. So it always amazes me how simple just the addition of a couple of plants and some color really will turn a space around.
It's always fascinated me, the culture of gardeners is you move to a new city and if you're lonely or want to make friends, you just join a garden club. And you ask somebody, how was your garden last year? And boom, instant conversation.
Absolutely.
Or you grow like a couple of zucchinis and then you run around the neighborhood giving away zucchinis. I wanted to ask you about a concept that you're working on that I'm not that familiar with, is this idea of a rain garden.
Yeah, I fell in love with the idea of rain gardens because we have so much rain through those three seasons, starting in the fall, going through the winter, and all the way through the spring, even into the summer. They say that the rain stops on the 5th of July. We always have a rainy 4th of July, but then that's it. So we have a lot of soggy areas, a lot of people with soggy lawns and wet gardens through the winter. And I went up to Seattle one year and took some classes on treating stormwater, dealing with stormwater on your property. And throughout the country, there's been a movement to disconnect your downspout from the stormwater, from the drains, and keep your stormwater on site. And so I learned a little bit about this idea where people were directing stormwater into little sunken depressions in their yards and letting that water percolate through the ground and get cleaned and get absorbed. And also, you know, that recharges the groundwater and also makes for a really beautiful and different kind of a garden. So it's an opportunity to create a wetland garden that where different kinds of plants thrive and would thrive in other parts of your garden. And it's a really fun thing for me to do as a designer to start a design with the placement of the rain garden and then work the design around that. And it's made for some really fun gardens, I think, in, you know, the group of gardens that I work on.
I'm fascinated with that because municipal water or city water is chlorinated and heavily treated. Mm-hmm. The rainwater is soft.
Yeah, it's soft, it's pure. But rainwater, when it flows off of our properties, hits the street and starts to pick up lots of pollutants, so it's no longer so clean and fresh. So by trying to keep it on our properties, we can really do a lot to improve the quality of the water in our own neck of the woods. And and reduce the amount of pollutants that end up in streams and waterways, in our local streams and waterways.
Wow, you triggered a memory. It's so different nowadays, and not everybody's organic or green. I know listeners of the show are conscious of it. Mm-hmm. I remember in the 70s, a neighbor used to change the oil in his car in his driveway and just open and let the crank oil just run down his driveway and hose it down into the storm sewer.
Wow.
If you do that today, I'm sure the Homeland Security is going to haul you off.
Not the greatest idea.
It's a different thinking, but I guess it's slow. It has to happen, right? We cannot be killing our planet at the pace that we've been doing it and not expect some repercussions. We are seeing it. I mean, this crazy climate change and the weird weather that everyone's experiencing.
Absolutely.
You're working with clients. You're designing these beautiful spaces. When your clients come to you, are they usually relaxed and optimistic, or do you occasionally get clients that are panicked or at their wit's end?
I would say that many of my clients are overwhelmed.
Yeah.
They are, they look at beautiful photographs in magazines and online and can see that there's possibilities for everybody's home. And yet they just look around and all they see is, you know, dreary, drab, nothing's going on. How can I turn this into a living, exciting, inspirational space? And so, or they're crazy gardeners and they already have a full space and they're not happy with it. They want to turn it around. And then they're overwhelmed because they have to rip everything out. Or they feel like they have to rip everything out and start again, which is not something that I believe in. I try not to be a slash and burn designer. I try to make the most of the good attributes that a garden is already offering, working with existing plants, trying to work by pruning them into their most desired form, untraining them from the gumdrops that they might have become, things like that.
I'm fascinated by the entire field because I consider it like painting or writing music. It's a skill set that I don't possess. I would imagine that people move into properties and they're instantly inheriting somebody else's problems.
Yes.
Or in some cases, they've lived there a while and created their own by overplanting.
In both can be true, for sure. It's always nice when somebody has some inspiration, some photograph, or some spark that is a direction for me to help guide that garden journey. It's more difficult, I think, when there is no inspiration and they're just overwhelmed and don't know where to turn. They just want something that's beautiful because beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So if I don't have a sense of what's beautiful to you, how can I create your perfect garden? So I try to get to know my clients. I try to learn a little bit about their background, where they grew up, the kinds of things that, like their favorite kind of an environment, you know, like when you think of a beautiful place, what is that to you? And then I try to create those kinds of spaces for them, if I can, or at least use it as a jumping off point.
You know, my wife and I, sometimes we talk about some of the gardens that we've seen on our travels, and we always talk about Australia as being some of the best gardens we've ever seen. And I would imagine when you start with a client who doesn't know what they want, it must be an exercise in patience with them.
I am a very patient person, and I think that that kind of coaxing out of information is something that I'm pretty good at. So I try to I try to pull out information as best I can. If I can't get any information, you know, I look around their house and see what they've done in there. I look around the outside of their house, see what kind of colors they might have chosen. If all else fails, they get the garden of my dreams.
I remember being asked about smell in the garden. And it never even factored into my consciousness that you would design a garden using fragrance as one of the variables.
Yeah.
Plants must grow so quickly, though, in Portland that you can afford to make a mistake and next season or the season after, it's okay. You can swap it out or grow something new.
Well, people in Portland, gardeners in Portland, are very famous for zonal denial. We tend to plant well beyond our zone, and we love plants from New Zealand, and we love exotic plants. If you just walk around this town, you'll see very unusual plant material in just average gardens, because people are kind of plant nuts, and the availability of plants is really high. So we have, you know, everyday gardeners that are exposed to more than just the Home Depot box type plants, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I understand. New Zealand, wow.
Yeah, yeah. We have some similarities in our climate to some areas in New Zealand, and so, we have some growers here. Zero Plants, for one, is a great grower of they love New Zealand plants. So they grow a lot of those and introduce them to a lot of our local nurseries. So they're out there and available to us. These are, you know, both growing them as annuals and growing them, trying to make a go of it in the garden.
Nice. We should caution our listeners, Amy, that never smuggle plants internationally. You don't want to be the person in jail when they say, hey, what are you in for? Well, I brought home a plant from New Zealand.
Yeah, don't do that.
Work with professionals. I just glanced at the clock and our time is whipping by. Okay. And now's the time in the show where we play a game called Five Quick Questions.
Okay.
This is your chance to share your wisdom and experience with novice rookie gardeners. Are you ready to play?
Let's try it.
Be nimble, because I've changed the questions up for 2015.
Okay.
Question number one. What is the funniest or most outrageous or unusual gardening mistake that you've ever made that you're willing to admit to in public?
Garden mistake. Let's see. I would say that I'm kind of a cautious gardener. I'm not, I wouldn't say that I make giant garden mistakes. I mean, I'm not by any means a perfect gardener, but I would just say that I guess I could tell you that the beautiful golden Deodar cedar in my backyard, that was a really stupid move. I knew it at the time that I planted it. I knew that it was too big for the yard. I knew that I just loved it, and I wanted something that was going to grow fast, and that it did. And every year, as it keeps getting bigger and bigger, I just try to estimate its ultimate size, and as it's going to, I know it's going to eat my house. But last winter, its top blew out, so I think maybe it's telling me that it's okay to put something new in its place.
Ooh, that'll be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It must be tricky. Sometimes you have to give yourself permission, right?
Definitely. I think that's one of the hardest things.
Yeah. Question number two. If you were only allowed to grow three plants next season, what three plants would you have to grow?
Well, I am a big conifer fan, and amongst the family of conifers, I really am enamored by the cryptomerias of Japanese cedar. So So I am always, I'm a collector of dwarf conifers, and always looking for new ones in as many colors as I can possibly find. So I have been trying to grow a type of a dwarf Korean fir called Silver Pearl for quite a while now. I got an opportunity to pick up a couple of these little one-gallon plants, and I gave a couple to friends, and then I killed my own. So that is a plant that I am really committed to growing, and I just love its tininess and its color. It's got silver on the backsides of its leaves, and it stays really miniature. So I love giant plants, and I love miniature plants. That would be definitely a plant that I want to try to grow this year.
The Silver Pearl. I'm going to put a link up. Dwarf Korean fir. Mm-hmm. It actually kind of struck me. I never have thought about Portland as a big place to grow conifers, but I...
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really amazing conifer growers here. And I have a little rockery in the front of my house, so it's a perfect place to show off little dwarf conifers.
When I was a kid...
Especially miniatures.
They always used to say, and you can tell me because you'll know more than I do. They used to say you could predict how severe a winter was going to be by the number of cones on a spruce tree or a pine tree.
Hmm. Yeah, I think there's definitely a relationship between the stress and the amount of seed produced. So yes, I would say that is true.
Yeah, that would make sense. Like in dry summers, the tree would instinctively try to propagate more seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah.
Very good. Question three. Now, we talk about websites. I want all the listeners to go to Amy's website at plan-it-earthdesign.com. Do you have one or two favorite gardening resource websites that you could share?
Yeah, I do. Here, again, these are pretty regional choices, but we have a great website called greatplantpicks.org. That is plants that are specifically suited to the Pacific Northwest. It is a list of plants that comes out every year, and by some of the best growers in our region, and they are a list of their favorite plants, and they include trees, shrubs, perennials, ground covers, vines. So the whole gamut is covered, and lately in the past couple of years they've been concentrating, giving more of a theme to their choices. So there was plants, scented plants, or particularly shady plants, or hot sunny plants have been on the list. And this has been going on for quite a few years. So the Great Plant Picks website has an amazing selection of go-to plants for the Pacific Northwest that are just fantastic and pretty much can't fail.
Mm. Good, good, good.
And then the other local resource that I really like is another website called plantlust.com.
And plantlust, that is that's good.
Really unusual plant material that where, you know, you, as when you look for plants, particularly unusual plants, and you're looking online for information about them, this website has taken all the resources that they can find on a particular plant and put them all together on one site. So you'll get 5 or 6 different descriptions of the plant from different nurseries that grow them. So it's a great way to kind of compare and contrast what people are saying about particular plants.
I love it. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no reason to be bored in a garden, is there?
That's for sure. There's so much out there.
Question 4. Do you have a favorite gardening book that you can suggest?
I do. I recently read, well, there's 2 books. Am I allowed to share 2 books?
Absolutely.
Okay. The first book that was a real game changer for me was Bringing Nature Home by Douglas Tallamy, mm-hmm. which is really drove home the relationship between insects and wildlife. in a way that I never appreciated before. So it really, talking about, we so often think about insects as being bad in the garden, even though we know there are beneficials. But when you think of that, just the web of life, just how important insects are to birds, for example. We love birds in our garden, but without insects, the birds have a hard time raising their young, particularly caterpillars. So this book just really talks all about that relationship, which I thought was just amazing and very exciting and very different. That was kind of a game changer for me. And then the other book that I just finished reading is called The Soil Will Save Us. And that is a book by Kristin Olson. And it talks about the magical life below the soil, microbes and their importance and how they create beautiful soil that make our gardens grow. And it talks a lot about sequestering carbon in the soil. That's a really, I think, really exciting new idea. Even the idea that farmers can be paid for storing carbon in the soil is such a radical thought. And that's something that Chris talks about in her book.
Ooh.
This idea of using animals and plants to improve soil health and maybe save the planet. I don't know. I think that's so exciting.
All right. I'll have links, clickable links up on the site at Back to My Garden. Got to read this book now. You made it sound amazing.
It is.
Yeah, good, good. Question 5 is a fun one. There's no right or wrong answer. Is there anything that you've never grown that you're just itching to experiment with?
I, right now, as I kind of mentioned, my garden is in destructo mode. I'm going to have to do something with that big deodar cedar. I have some big plants that died over last summer because they didn't get enough water. I'm going to be growing a lot this coming year. And I'm going to take this opportunity now that I have a lot of room in my garden to really include a lot more native plants. I always have an interest in natives, but I think I'm going to give them a little bit more weight as I'm choosing my plant palette to the plants that are going to support the insects and the birds because I love to have wildlife in the garden. So native plants are what I'm going to be including this year.
Wow, hang on, I'm writing all this down. Choosing a plant palette that serves nature.
Right.
That'll be the tweetable quote. That's beautiful. Yeah, back to the 70s, I mean, you killed all bugs. I mean, you went to the hardware store and you could buy 40 kinds of poison.
Still can.
Well, it's changing. It has to change. I mean...
It does. I used to work at a nursery when I first started, when I moved out here. And we had, you know, what we called the wall of death. It was the biggest display in the entire store was all of the various poisons that we carried to kill this and kill that. And it was a big deal when the employees talked the management into moving the wall of death outside of the store where it wouldn't smell so bad. Because it was just awful to kind of walk into this retail space and just smell toxins and poisons.
Amazing. The consciousness is changing, the conversation is evolving, and it has to. And I'm sure we're doing our part, raise the awareness.
Yeah.
I want all the listeners to head over, reach out to Amy through her blog or her website at planetearthdesign.com. That's plan-it-earthdesign.com. I'll have the links up to the plants and resources and books that Amy shared. Amy, the time has flown by. You've been a tremendous guest.
Thanks. It's been a lot of fun being on, and I've really enjoyed our conversation.
We have listeners, I guess now, 60-plus countries. Can you leave us with either a pearl of wisdom or a note of encouragement? And I'll give you the last word to the listeners today.
Well, let's see. I would say don't be afraid to experiment in your garden, because plants are very forgiving, and anything is possible. So never be afraid of experimentation. And don't forget about drainage.
Fantastic.
That's my other little pearl of wisdom, particularly if you live in a dry climate, don't wither away that resource. And if you live in a wet climate, don't forget that water flows downhill and can make trouble for you.
Outstanding. Amy, thanks so much for being a guest.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Dave.